It's a pleasure to see everybody in August. We weren't sure we'd have a sufficient quorum, but you've pleasantly surprised all of us here. It is my pleasure, though, to introduce our newest member of the higher education community here in Connecticut. We are honored and delighted to have Dr. Gregory Gray here today. He cannot stay with us, but I thought it would be important to introduce him to folks. So, Dr. Gray, I don't know if you'd like to say a word.
Hello, everyone. Forgive me. The first thing I need to say is I got to run.
And usually I'm loud enough people can hear me, and I don't want to make a speech except I've had a chance to be in this building all day talking with individuals about our new state system for higher education and the plan that we're developing that we'll be sharing with all of you hopefully by November or so. As you know, I think there's a very, very bright future for our combined community colleges, Charter Oaks, and the universities now in developing a new system. My commitment is very simple because all of you appreciate what I'm coming into. My Board of Regents has given me 26 objectives for this year to accomplish, and they've been nice enough to say, well, if you don't get them all done, that's okay, but it's something we should be moving towards, which I agree to. But there are actually three overarching goals that I'm dealing with this year. First of all, as you can all appreciate, is restoring trust and integrity to our system. So literally everything that's done in our system will be very transparent. The public and every one of you and anyone else can take a look at what we're doing. May not agree with it, but I guarantee you it will be transparent and open for observation. The other thing that I was talking about a few minutes ago is that we are an infant as an organization. We've been around for 18 months now. Most of that was in disarray. So although it won't make the headlines, nor is it very sexy, we're developing a brand new organization. And I have to make sure that that actually gets up and running and taken care of. And thirdly, like most of you, I'm concerned about resources and financing for higher education in our system, while at the same time keeping any tuition increases to our students at the very, very minimum. So far I'm having a lot of fun getting to meet a lot of wonderful people. I do look forward to being part of this group. As I say, I apologize on my first meeting with you. I have to leave. So nice to meet you all. Thank you.
A pleasure, Dr. Gray. We look forward to your involvement with the group. Welcome to Connecticut. Indeed. Just FYI, we are, in fact, I believe, being filmed again today, so they have asked us in the past to just go around the room if we could and introduce ourselves and what our organization. And please use the microphone, which I often forget myself. I'm wondering, Teresa, if you would start, please.
Thank you very much. Teresa Madonna, formerly of Sacred Heart University.
Good afternoon. Dr. Pamela Reed, University of St. Joseph, but representing the Connecticut Council of Independent Colleges.
Hi, I'm Carrie Kelly. I'm with the Office of Policy and Management.
John Shima with the Metro Hartford Alliance.
I'm Catherine Smith, the Commissioner of the Department of Economic and Community Development.
Judy Goldfarb, a governor appointment with an early childhood background.
I'm John Harnick from the Office of Legislative Management.
I'm a state representative, Roberta Willis, House Chair of the Higher Education and Employment Advancement Committee.
Judy Resnick, CBIA Education Foundation Executive Director and Chairman, I guess, of the Commission.
Beth Bai, State Senator from the 5th District and Co-Chair of Higher Education.
I'm Braden Hosh. I'm with the Board of Regents. I'm President Gray's designee to the Commission.
Jason Jakubowski, I'm the Vice President for Government Relations at Hospital for Special Care in New Britain.
I'm Hedley Freak from the University of Connecticut.
I'm Sally Reese, Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at UConn.
Thank you very much. So here we are once again. It's yet a month later. Have made some progress and have a wonderful agenda ahead of us. So if I may ask for a motion to approve the minutes from our July meeting, please. And do I have a second? Thank you very much. All in favor? Those opposed? And one abstention. You don't get to vote. That's right.
I don't understand.
Thank you. Robert's rules is never my strength. So if you remember last time we met, we had a discussion about the fact that the RFP had been released and, in fact, was due back to the state by July 18th. And, in fact, we that happened. There were two proposals that were received and judged to be the correct word, John?
Evaluated.
Evaluated. They were complete applications. As you all know, I sent an email out to the commission talking about the evaluation committee that we appointed to review these proposals, and that group met yesterday. So at this point, I'd like to turn it over to John, who can talk with us about next steps within the RFP process.
Okay, thank you. So where we are with this is, as Judy mentioned, she just handed me the committee's recommendation. So we will start reviewing that, and if there's any follow-up questions, we will get back to her and the committee. After once we've answered all those questions, the next step in the process here at JCLM is that any contract over $50,000 has to go for what we call personal policies approval. So we will prepare a letter, send that to the leadership. They will approve the contract. Once that happens, we will actually work with the vendor to finalize the details of a contract with them. And our target date for having this all completed is mid-September, so we will act as quickly as we can. A lot of things need to happen between now and then, and we'll do everything we can to make them happen. The one thing I just want to just remind everybody, as I have in the past, is that we're still in a silent period as far as talking with either proposer at this point. So until a contract is signed and sealed, we won't be talking to either vendor other than to enter into a contract. So. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Anybody have any questions? Just as a way of background to remind you who actually served on the committee, it was Representative Willis, it was myself, it was Sally Reese, who was gracious enough to try to call in, and we were more efficient. but we had a nice opportunity yesterday to talk. Braden Hosh from the Board of Regents, Judy Griman participated by telephone, and John Shimo. And did I miss anybody? I think that was it. So,
the governor's office.
Oh, and I'm sorry, and Aaron Smith. Not a good idea to forget the governor's office representative, Aaron Smith, who was gracious to, and I must thank the committee for really a very thoughtful review process. So we had a very robust discussion, and we look forward to our next steps with the process. So thank you again, John Harnick and Tina Moore from OLM that are helping guide us to make sure that we hit the ground running appropriately and legally. And with that, I think many of you at the last meeting really looked for data. People are very hungry to take a look at our state and what demographics, what information do we have that will help guide our development of the RFP process. And with that, there was probably nobody better to turn to than Braden Hosh at the Board of Regents. Braden, as you know, is the Director of Policy and Research, and he also carries two titles, an Interim Director of Academic Affairs. That's in between taking care of a 1- and 3-year-old, I think, as well. And he has graciously agreed to provide a presentation today, which he assures me will be very sobering. So with that, let me turn it over to Braden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I appreciate the commission to give me this opportunity to talk to you some more about Connecticut data. Monica Chan from NEBI gave a great overview of some of the regional context and some of the national context. What I'm going to do today is put our data into more of that with a specific focus on Connecticut. And I'm going to look at some historical trends and some projections into the future on this. And we're going to start off with population change because so much of this really centers on people. Education is about people. And if you're unaware of what the demographics look like, it can produce policies that are not necessarily going the right direction. Then we're going to put that in the context of enrollment completions and educational attainment, because once you have a basis for the population trends, some of what has occurred in the higher education landscape in the past two or three decades makes better sense. And then I'm going to finish up talking about some important indicators and opportunities that I think we have as a state, including college readiness. Student success is obviously a big one, but also affordability, the financing model for higher education, as well as innovation, economic development, and equity. I'm really going to just be touching on some of those last items. I think there's clearly room for us to do some more things. Your packet has more slides than we're actually going to really discuss. A lot of these are set up to animate. So the screen behind you, you'll actually get to see some of this. The story I want to start actually starts back at 1900, and this is what's called a population pyramid. We're not spending much time on 1900, but we have to start here. This is a population pyramid, and demographers take men and women, they divide them up by gender, and then chop them up by age so that you've got 0 to 4 at the bottom and 80 plus at the top, and every bar is about a five-year bracket in between. And this is what a traditional society looks like. That's why it's called a population pyramid. There are more people at the bottom and fewer people at the top. This is what most societies look like in a traditional structure. This is 1950. And what you see in this structure here is that the baby bust is down there at the bottom, and the baby boom is sort of blossoming just below it. So something there that looks more like the Ace of Spades with a big base. That's 1950. Fast forwarding to 1980, you see the baby boom, and then behind it, Gen X. And this, you also start to see things flattening out at the top. Baby boomers are finishing up college just about at this point. They move into their prime earning years in the 1990s, along with an internet bubble and a big economic boom. That group of people is driving the economy. This is 2000, and then this is 2010. And what we've seen is that our society as a whole has radically changed shape. Let me just take you back through history here real fast so you can see this, 1900 to 2010. And then I'm going to take you to 2020, 2030, 2040, 2050. And you start to see, I mean, it's really a bullet, okay? But it's a bullet with a big, big point going way, way up there past what the demographic projections show. So that there at 80 plus, we really have people going up to the hundreds. But you see a sizable, sizable chunk of the population now over 80 by 2050 compared to the population that we currently have in higher education, which is usually in the 20 to 24-year-old range. Here's Connecticut. This is 1990. And one of the striking things about this particular chart is that the baby boom generation is a larger proportion here in Connecticut, and Gen X is a smaller proportion, so that the hips on this particular pyramid are wider than they are in the country as a whole. This is 2000. On the pyramid. This is 2000, and you actually see Gen Y there as the baby boom echo a little bit more prominently here. And then behind them, by 2010, you start to see another dip. Things level out a little bit. But the children of Gen X also are slightly smaller group. You really see it on this particular slide. I got my pointer up and working. Let's see here. When my laser works, it works well. When it doesn't work, it doesn't work at all. What you actually see here, maybe I'll do it with a pointer, you see that there's a smaller group of people here than there were the 10 years before. So that's 2010. This is 2020. So there's actually a drop in the 20 to 24-year-old population. And this is what you've been hearing about in terms of the decline in college-age people. And it continues through to 2030. So what are the actual numbers on this? Nationwide, we're expecting 20 to 24-year-olds to be flat across the country, although there's great regional variation. It's only a net increase of 19,000. But in the 70-plus range, it's almost 9 million people. By 2030, you're talking 2.4 million people additional 20 to 24, but 23.7 in the 70-plus range. That's a tenfold difference, mind you. And then you see the numbers go up from there, so that by 2050 it's 6.4 million people, 20 to 24, but 39 million more people over age 70. Here's Connecticut. We actually have a drop to 2020 in the college age range, 18,000 fewer people in that range, with almost 90,000 more 70 plus. And then you see again the numbers increase even further to 2030. Yes. Census estimates on that, generally speaking, are very conservative, meaning that they model it based on the prior decade. So it basically assumes that immigration policy will more or less be the same as it was. So, and what we saw from Patrick's presentation last time is that our net in-out was about even. Were we to attract more people to Connecticut, this would obviously change. That said, we've got a long history, several decades of history, that suggests that our net in-out has been pretty close to even. So now, a national change in immigration policy could affect this markedly, but you know, I'm not going to handicap that today with our current Congress. This looks at it, the same picture a slightly different way. This actually takes the people who are age zero, basically births, and the people who are 85 and older over the course of about two decades. And what you see, sorry, three decades. I'm sorry, that slide should say 1980 to 2011. And in the 1980s, what you see is that the proportion and actually the numbers of people age zero and age 85 and older are about even. They go up from about the high 30,000s to the high 40,000s. But over the next two decades, what you see is population decline among age zero and huge increase in the 85 plus. So while it was a 1-to-1 ratio in the 80s, it ends up being a more than 2-to-1 ratio by 2011. And we don't see any signs of this changing. In fact, some of the estimates for 2011, 2012, going forward, because of the economic downturn, birth rates were actually lower than expected. So we have not yet come out of that birth rate dip. So I use this to sort of wrap up the population piece to say the landscape of our demography is changing in terms of the number of people that we typically put into higher education. The group immediately coming out of K-12 is simply going to get smaller. The opportunity is that there are more people who are going to be aged 25 to 34 and 35 to 44. So there are more people in those age ranges, and that can be an opportunity. It also means that there's going to be a shift in budget priorities from education to healthcare. If money follows people, and I think it typically does in government, then we can simply expect there to be more dollars there. And John, I'll get to you in just a second. And I also think that there's going to be a shift in the mission of higher ed to serve more people across the lifespan than focusing on just the 20 to 24 year olds. John.
What percentage of our college population are Connecticut residents?
I don't have that number off the top of my head. I can rough it out, but I'll misspeak, but I can get you that number. Selectivity matters quite a bit. So at a place like Yale, Connecticut residents are only about 2 to 4%. There's a slightly disproportionate representation of students from New England at are Ivies, but they're national institutions that recruit nationally, and they actually balance by state.
Well, I'm just trying to reconcile the data that you just shown us, you know, against, you know, what that percentage is.
Yeah. That's a number I will get back to you. So I'll start making some notes about things that need to come back, but I'll get that back to you. Let's talk about this in terms of educational attainment and what it means for high school graduates and enrollments and completions. This is the high school graduates, and this is actual graduates from public high schools. Private high school graduates is a harder and slipperier number to come across. It's not insignificant. It's 5,000 to 6,000 a year, but the reporting on this can be hard to get. But you can add about 5,000 people, especially on the tail end of this. And what you see is a big peak up in the 1970s, a large dip down into the early 90s, and this is what caused the enrollment crises of the early 90s for those of you who were around in higher ed at that point in time. And then as Gen Y comes into higher education, starting in the mid-90s, going through all the way through 2008, I think, is where we peak, that group of people has driven enrollment across Connecticut and across the United States. There are college presidents who have never been in an environment where enrollment has not just naturally gone up. There are administrators who have made their whole careers where enrollment has always just naturally gone up. And the playbook is filled with things that work when enrollment is going up. We're about to see the people coming into higher education, that number of folks going down. And that number there is just projected from the other things that I've shown you, and it shouldn't come as a surprise. I'm about to superimpose these, but here's Connecticut undergraduate fall headcount enrollment. And this goes, I don't have quite as much of a snapshot. Our data back at the office only go back to 1976. At the bottom are the community technical colleges, which does make up the lion's share of enrollments in terms of, I guess, a plurality anyway. The technical colleges merged with the community colleges in 1993. I have them included before that. Above that, you've got the Connecticut State University system. You've then got UConn, above that, believe it or not, actually there's a small teeny tiny line there for Charter Oak in between those. UConn is above that. You see some increases there. And then you also see the independent institutions in the state. This does not include non-degree granting institutions. So it does not include places like Lincoln Tech or Porter and Chester. Now, I'm going to superimpose high school graduates on here. And high school graduates don't make up all of your enrollment all at the same time, but if you happen to move it 3 years ahead, that line shows up exactly tracking college enrollment by 3 years. And so if nothing changes, and this is, I think, where we come back to Commissioner Smith's question about assumptions, because when you're making projections, you're always making assumptions. But if nothing changes, this is what I would expect to happen with college enrollments, is that I would expect them to go down. And so moving on to that, you now sort of see a light projection on here. What I have done is I have taken that enrollment piece and I've divided it between full-time and part-time. So full-time is the dark piece at the bottom, and then part-time is the lighter piece at the top, and the very light stuff is the projected change going out to about 2025. What you see there is actually that this is the enrollment increases have been driven by an increase in full-time students. Remember, we said there were a bunch of young people coming out of high school. They tend to enroll full-time. And so we see the driving force of our enrollment increase be full-time students. In higher education, we make a conversion called full-time equivalents, so that we take the part-time students and we apply a multiplier to them, and we come up with a full-time equivalent, or FTE, which is what I do in this slide. And the only thing that really does is it changes the slope of this slightly. But by and large, we have the same graph. This is now just converted to full-time equivalency. And what I'm going to do now is the same trick with undergraduate completions. This is the undergraduate completions line. For the number of people who are completing in undergraduate degrees and certificates, and I'm counting certificates as a third of a completion here, but both associates and bachelors are counted as one. That's what undergraduate completions look like. And if I again do the same trick, move it back by 2 years, we see it tracks almost exactly. So the concern is that absent significant change in the system, we're going to forecast declines in college graduates. Now, I don't want to just sort of cast that out without some hope. If you see at the very end of this, that line is rising up a little bit off of the graph. And that's encouraging. I know the community college preliminary numbers for completions show an increase of 8% from last year, which is extraordinarily good. That's still a function of more people enrolling. It's not immediately clear if it's rising up off of this line because that full-time equivalent conversion is, you know, it's an estimate, it's a conversion, or if we really are seeing system-level improvement. But for us to meet some of the goals that have been set by the Obama administration, we have to see that red line slope increase pretty dramatically, or at least diverge from the enrollment line.
Headley. You said that an associate's degree and a bachelor's degree are each one.
Yes.
What happens if you get both?
Then
you count twice?
This is not people. This is completions. So, indeed, you can earn both. There are some people, there is a small fraction of people in here who are earning two bachelor's degrees, and they're counted as two. If we were to magically have the unit record system that we should have over this period of time and unduplicate, you would actually see this line sink a little bit. Let's talk educational attainment then, because I think this actually tells us where the game is. This is the population age 25 to 44. And we've selected this because this is primarily where you see most of the effects of our higher education system. We have some students who are 45 and older in degree and certificate programs. but not many. And most of the national data actually tell us that after 25, we don't see huge increases in educational attainment just in general. But we have populations here that we wanted to consider. So what we've got is everybody in the state. This is from the 2011 American Community Survey. It's a one-year estimate. There's some noise in this. It's not a huge sample, but good enough. And what you see here is an attainment rate of an associate's degree or higher of 47.6%. And that's composed of the associate's degree line at 7.6%, the bachelor's degree line of 24.3%, and the graduate or professional degree at 15.7%. So that's the group that we're trying to increase. The Obama administration numbers, they want 60% by 2020 for the country. We're a leading state in this game, and so Connecticut's number would have to be higher than 60%. And plus, we don't want to just be average. We need to be a leader. So 60% is probably a floor for where we need to be. There's a remaining 43.5% who have at least a high school diploma but no college degree. And I would at least submit the thought that this is likely where the game needs to be won in terms of the attainment challenge. Coming out of high school every year, we have 35 to 40,000 students. We know that about 70% of them enroll in college right away. About 4,000 go to the state universities. 6,000 go to the community colleges. Of the 6,000, 70% need remediation. That gets you down to about 4,000, 5,000 students we should be working with every year to help bolster things. And we've got policy in place, thanks to some of the people sitting at this table, that I think will address some of that. But that's only 4,000 to 5,000 people a year. That number there, 389,325, is the group that we have to improve their educational prospects. And it's that group where the attainment challenge will be won if we're trying to hit one of those goals of a 60% number. So quickly, I also want to move to race ethnicity. This gets a lot of press already that we certainly have a change in the proportion of students who are white, in that it's decreasing, and an increase in the proportion of students who are Hispanic and Asian in this state, for that matter. The African American population actually remains relatively level as a proportion of our population. For those of you who are real data wonks, you know that the race ethnicity categories change about that time where there's a break. This particular chart is from WICHE, the Western Interstate Commission for Higher Education. It's the Western State counterpart of NEBI. And they do this periodically, and so they do it for all 50 states. Their data are a little bit older as a result, and so the numbers are slightly different from what I showed you. But nevertheless, a good depiction of what happens with our race ethnicity challenges. Really only in that we historically have seen the Hispanic population and the African American population not achieve degree outcomes the way our white students have. I mean, this has just been a historical reality. It's one of those things that's a lot easier to address, actually, than not having the people at all, which is why I started with the population challenge. We can adjust our practices so that Hispanic students are just as educated as white students. It's hard when you don't have the students to educate. This is the attainment. I'm going to ring an alarm bell here, and then I will mitigate it somewhat. This is the attainment but for 45 to 50-year-olds, and again, this chart is from WICHE. Their ultimate source is the census. But this is 45 to 50-year-olds by race. So over on the left, you have Asians. In the yellow, you have black, non-Hispanic, and this is the old race categories. In the green, you have Hispanic, and in the blue, you have white, non-Hispanic. And ultimately, because of the population change, we were trying to make sure that each generation has a higher level of education than the previous generation. You actually see that by race ethnicity for three groups, but not for Hispanics, which are our fastest growing group. And that is a significant issue that I think we need to stay focused on, which is why I will finish with some things about equity. That may actually be an artifact of some of the sampling patterns. What we actually are about to see in the completions, and this is completions of undergraduate degrees and certificates by race or ethnicity. And again, I put Hispanic in the green and again, there's that break because of the race ethnicity categories, is that actually our Hispanic numbers are starting to go out the roof. So we actually may be addressing this right now, but it's something to watch very, very closely as we move forward in time. But more or less what we've seen in terms of increases is we've seen an increase in all the groups that we would expect to see because of the population. It's important when you're looking at these numbers that you actually ask people what proportion of the total are Hispanics or African Americans, because of this overarching increase overall, what you will sometimes see in research reports is that we graduated 10% more Hispanics this year than last year. Well, that's because we had 10% more enroll 5 years ago. And so the real question about system efficiency is, are they making up a larger share of the population of graduates? And so that's important. Quickly about graduate students, because this often gets the short shrift in these presentations, but I will spend some time on it. This, again, gives us enrollment 1976 to 2012. Independent institutions in our state make up the lion's share of this, and actually it's a share that's increasing. The state universities have had a robust graduate program. Those numbers have been dropping in recent years. You definitely see it on this chart. The drop was 10% last year. I'll show you why in just a second. UConn has been stable, if not increasing, but the state university line is, sort of adds an optical illusion there. This is the graduate student enrollment by full-time, part-time. And the reason why this is particularly important is that, again, you see Gen Y and you see some economic effects pushing this. And so we've got more and more full-time graduate students. Full-time graduate students tend to be younger. And part-time graduate students tend to be older, but we see a significantly lower number of part-time grad students in our state institutions. I have a speculation on that. I'll get to that in just a minute towards the end. But because the state universities have really run many of their graduate programs on part-time enrollments, that's been the major share of the decline. The full-time enrollment has been relatively stable in their graduate programs, but part-time has been going down. This is graduate degree completions. And again, because we have that large number of full-time graduate students going into the system, that's driving this effect, which is a good thing. We want those to go up. So I'm going to shift now, actually, to the five opportunities I want to talk about. This is college readiness. And I have limited this to students entering two-year institutions. I don't want anyone to leave with the misimpression that every student who enrolls at any four-year institution is ready for college. There is a large data set that says they are not. The comparability among those is a little bit tricky. And so this particular data set is from Complete College America. Because community colleges are open admissions, it's a little bit easier to compare these and know it's a reasonable comparison. The four-year chart is a little bit less stable, I think, in terms of a data source. And also, as a note, the reason why Connecticut has an asterisk is that we're not actually in this report. We joined Complete College America as a data provider just after this data collection. And so what I actually have on here is a more recent year. I think that's entering in 2008, whereas this other chart is entering in 2006. But that said, our numbers have remained relatively stable at 70% over the past, really, almost decade. So Connecticut would have been there in 2006 had we reported those data. And what it says is that the students entering our community colleges are often determined to need remedial coursework. Time to degree is another one that's important. And I think certificate and associate's degrees are more accurate, though quite disturbing as far as I see them. Students who are entering as full-time pursuing an associate's degree, the average time to degree is 4.3 years. And if you enter part-time and finish, which is actually not often the case, but if you enter part-time and finish, the average is 5.6 years. That's a long, long time. And that actually puts us about in the middle of the pack. Those certificate-seeking students, those are one-year certificates. And that number is at 3.4 and 5. Part of the reason for that is that certificates are often awarded at the same time as the bachelor's degree. As the associate's degree. So a student will start off saying, yes, I'm degree seeking for a certificate, or I'm certificate seeking. They will switch into an associate's degree program and finish the associate's degree program, and the certificate will be awarded at the same time. The extent to which that's a good practice is another question, but that's part of what drives that set of data. And we're kind of in the middle of the pack for the 26 states that reported. The asterisks are, yes.
You have a question.
Brandon, do you have any data on the non-native English speakers in terms of the time it takes them to get through?
We don't. And actually, in higher education in general, we don't capture a non-native English speaker the same way K-12 does. So it's a very challenging number to have that is reliable. So you might be able to find some institutional data where it is tracked and put on databases as an indicator, but often it's not. And it just simply makes the number a little bit squishy when you see it, if somebody releases it. The bachelor's degrees have an asterisk because the way Complete College America asked for this to be reported actually involved a statewide longitudinal data system, which we don't yet have operational. And so you're supposed to include all credits that were counted toward degree and all time counted toward degree, regardless of whether the person started at the four-year institution or not. And the state universities in UConn don't always have an accurate start date for when the transfer student arrived. So we've got accurate dates for when our students arrived as full-time students, but it's sometimes not as accurate. So I actually think those numbers are pretty close, but when you see the credits, you'll see why I've got an asterisk on there. This is the average number of credits earned, and this is where I come back to the certificate folks having their certificates awarded coterminously. The average number of credits earned by somebody seeking an associate's degree in our community colleges is over 80. And, yes, I just saw the chair mouth. It seems a little bit beyond what we expect. And this is also not completely out of line with what we see in other community colleges. Complete College America is an advocacy group for improving educational attainment, and this is one of their issues, saying that, A, there should be policies that limit the number of credits in an associate's degree. With my other hat on, with academic affairs on, some of that ends up being challenging in ways in an associate's degree program that you don't see in bachelor's degree programs. And I can come back to that, but especially math requirements where you need calculus, say, in a physics major, in a bachelor's program, you can say, well, yes, I'm expecting people to knock out the college algebra and pre-calc and everything else to get to the calculus with electives. But in those associate's degree programs, you don't have the electives there to play with. And so that extra number of credits is in part an artifact of having to use additional credits to get to the level of mathematics needed. It's not entirely the issue. There are other reasons that number is as high as it is, but it clearly looks like it should be lower. The bachelor seeking number, 125, actually looks pretty good, and that was consistent across the state universities and UConn. The asterisk is there because those are credits only earned at UConn and credits only earned at the CSUs. It's not credits earned elsewhere, whereas some of the other Complete College America states were reporting the credits earned elsewhere, and that's why our numbers look pretty darn good. In fact, some people are averaging fewer credits than are needed for a bachelor's degree. So that's also how I know that this is not being fully captured. So asterisk with the data. I think the data need closer attention. Quickly, and I'm almost done, affordability. This is mean household income in Connecticut, 1987 to 2011, and it goes up nicely. It starts to flatten out towards the end of the decade, as we are all well aware. The problem is that when, and that's graphed over on that left-hand axis. On the right-hand axis, I'm about to graph tuition and required fees for full-time undergraduates as a percentage of median household income. And that number goes up pretty steadily throughout the period. It's flat in, say, anywhere between 1997 to, say, 2002, but then continues to march upward as a percentage. And this is a percentage of the state average. It's not a percentage of the student's household income. So remember that the median household income of students who are attending community colleges is significantly lower than those who are attending the state universities, which is lower than those attending UConn, because there's a relationship typically between socioeconomic status and selectivity of institutions. This is the state university tuition line. Same thing, that's as a percentage of the state median household income, and that's UConn. They all tend to move the same way because a lot of that is a reaction to state support in recessions. This is state appropriations, and this particular chart is from SHEO. This is the U.S. as a whole. And this is state appropriations and tuition revenue. Tuition revenue is net, so any institutional aid is subtracted out. So tuition revenue is in the red, and the educational appropriations for public institutions are in the gray. And actually, you see that it hasn't particularly varied all that much. It stays between about $11,000 and $12,000 throughout the period overall. However, the trend for state appropriations is by and large down, and the amount for net tuition revenue is by and large up. And that's what you hear out in the press, with students shouldering a larger and larger proportion of the cost of college. So that's just about even there in 2012. Whereas if you go back to 1987, there's a vastly different proportion. So that's in part the reaction that we see. This is Connecticut. As Monica noted, we are a high subsidy, high tuition state. And so there's a lot more tuition revenue and a lot more state subsidy. You do actually start to see that the amount of appropriations per FTE has been declining. These are in constant dollars, by the way, so it's not... there's no effects of inflation. It is with this HECA index, which is something that SHEA has developed. It's slightly above CPI, but below the HEPI that Common Fund uses. In any case, the point on all that is that, yes?
Braden, does that include state-appropriated fringe benefits or just tuition?
Yes, it's supposed to. It's also supposed to include state financial aid. So that would actually, believe it or not, that should have included KICS, even though you're averaging across the FTE for publics. So there's a little bit of noise in all these national numbers simply because everybody budgets and allocates slightly differently. I'm going to finish up with innovation. Distance learning is probably a poor proxy at this point for innovation. This set of numbers is preliminary, and I haven't listed any other states yet because I got it out of the collection level from IPEDS. It hasn't been statistically adjudicated. The first release is supposed to be in September or October, but I wanted to get it on the table now because I don't think that our relative position is going to change that much, but I didn't want to put things up with other states on there that would possibly place them in the wrong spot. I will tell you over on the far left is Arizona. Now, here's what this is. On the IPED survey, they asked institutions, please report of your undergraduate and graduate students how many are enrolled in exclusively distance learning, how many are enrolled in some distance learning, and how many are enrolled in no distance learning. So there's three different categories. From that, you can calculate by adding the first two together how many are enrolled in any distance learning. And that's what I've graphed here, is that the proportions of people who are undergraduate students at our two-year and four-year public and private colleges in the state are enrolled in any distance learning, and that number is about 15%, or one out of six is doing any distance learning at all. Arizona, by contrast, where the University of Phoenix is over there in the high 60 range. Now, I need to contextualize this a second. This is not about citizens of Connecticut or residents of Connecticut. This is about people who are attending Connecticut institutions. One of our huge data gaps in higher education right now is we don't know the location of people who are enrolled online. And it will continue to be a data gap. That from a policy standpoint, we don't know how many people in Connecticut are enrolled at the University of Phoenix or Capella or any of the other large providers. And we don't know how many of them are earning degrees and are in Connecticut. That's a big hole in what our knowledge base is. In any case, that's undergraduates. This is graduates. And what you tend to see in the change in this, our relative position actually goes up a state or two. But actually, the proportion of people goes down slightly. And this is where I come back to, I think, one of the reasons why you see a decrease in the state university part-time graduate enrollment is that that segment of the market is more predisposed to choose an online program than an on-ground program. And as a result, I rather suspect that the online providers are grabbing that chunk of the market away from the state universities. That's supposition, but I think it's reasonable inside of the context. So here's my closing observations, and I'm happy to answer any other questions people may have. I think that the implications of having fewer 18 to 24-year-olds are reasonably clear. There's going to be increased competition among institutions for students. That means more money spent on admissions, recruiting, marketing, than spending money in the classroom. At least that's what it meant back in the 90s when this happened before. There's going to be a shift to serving older students if institutions want to maintain their size, footprint, and budgets. We also need to do that if we want to meet our attainment goals once we set them. I think it's also going to mean a downward pressure on revenues. Fewer people, less money. The second point I would make is that, and this comes back to where I was superimposing high school graduates on enrollments and then college graduates on enrollments, is that the historical patterns of success that we've had in the past two decades are likely not going to be successful in the next two decades. At least they will not yield for us the results that we want to achieve. They will not get us to the Lumina goal. They won't get us to the Obama goal. And I think in closing, there are some contextual opportunities. I'm sure there's some more. College readiness is one that I think we've actually got some of the policy solutions in place. We simply need to implement them, which is a heavy, heavy lift. But I think in many ways we're headed down the right path. Student success is a biggie. Once they're in higher education, how do you ensure that they are learning, not just completing, but they are learning, and they're able to demonstrate all the competencies that we want them to acquire? Affordability is huge. We know that that's a challenge. As my daughter is three, Judy said, as I am looking at her 529 plan and I run the models on this, a place like where I went to school is projected to cost $650,000 for 4 years. That's a lot of money. And I have a one-year-old, too. Innovative models for learning and teaching. We've talked about some of those. I threw up some stuff about distance learning. Again, that's a proxy. There are lots of other ways for us to be innovative and transformative, but we have to advance that. When we find things that work, we need to scale them, and we need to make sure that they are working. But now is a good time for us to really be investing in the R&D on that. And then finally, equity and outcomes. What we know is that our population is changing. We have a historical pattern of not producing equitable outcomes in our educational system. The state will not thrive if we don't have the same level of attainment among all populations. Those are the populations that are growing, and they're the future of the state and the country. And so we've got to spend some time, energy, and investment, I think, working on those. So that's my last slide. I would be happy to entertain any questions people have.
Yeah, very sobering. A little scary. Questions for Braden. I wonder if I can start us off. I want to go back to the credit attainment, if you didn't guess. I do understand that, particularly in an associate's degree, that in the technical arenas, you know, math, engineering, that you know, even to subscribe to ABET accreditation and all of the stuff that goes with it, that they're in the 60s, but they're not in the 80s. Help me.
And this is an average, too, so you've got people who are far above that. And our state in this data collection shows up in the middle of the pack. I don't yet have broad explanations for why this is the case. It's clearly something that we're looking at. Complete College America has been encouraging us to set up pathways so that you have very clear curricula about what students should take first semester, second semester, third semester. One of the things that can cause this, though, and it's one of the problems with the first, second, third semester piece, is that it assumes everyone passes everything. And what we know, especially among populations that are challenged by money, family issues, other sorts of things, is that they don't always pass all their courses. And so Ds will significantly increase this number. So if you earn one D instead of earning 60 credits, you're now going to have to earn 63 because they don't always all count inside of your major or general education requirements. So that's an issue. Changing majors is always an issue. The metaphor I used on this with the Board of Governors that seemed to have some traction was that if you start from Connecticut and you drive to San Diego and halfway through you decide to now go to Seattle, you will have driven out of the way. And we know that more than one out of two people actually change their major in pursuing a degree. And so that adds time. Senator.
Thank you, Braden. I just wanted to raise an issue that maybe would be interesting for this committee. Representative Willis and I asked for an analysis from the community colleges of the number of credits by degree, by institution. And even across our own community colleges, some majors require 66 and another may require 60. And so I think that's something that we maybe would be helpful. There's a chart that we got which compared the different colleges and the different majors and the different credits, because that seems like a good place to start as we're talking to a strategic planner, is simply to say, okay, across our system, if you're pre-engineering, this is how many credits you need. Not to be, you know, put a stamp on everyone, but to have someone take an extra semester to get the same degree from the same system seems silly. So that's something we're going to look for some policy recommendations on. Thank you.
Representative Wills, you had a question?
Yes. Braden, I was wondering, I mean, we've done quite a bit of talking about cuts to higher education and faculty issues, but also college counselors and the ratio of college counselors to student population. Do you think that that could be, this could be indicative of the lack of good counseling, adequate counseling for someone who's going through the system? I mean, you often hear the stories where students just show up at a community college, enroll, and then go from thing to thing and don't seem to have a real plan.
That's possible, and perhaps even likely. One of the real questions is, to what extent do you need people to do that rather than have technology limit what somebody could take? If you happen to know somebody's pursuing, let's say it's an associate's degree in nursing, for instance, we know what the curriculum is. Why would we allow you to automatically register for things? There are some systems, and this again comes out of Complete College America, especially for some of these populations, where all of a sudden their schedule is built for them for next semester. So it's not a question of having to go through the course catalog to pick whatever course it is. Instead, they go up to the registration system, and it says, the next courses in your program are these. You're registered. Here's your schedule. Now go see an advisor if you need to switch out of them. So it's really a default issue. If you think back to books like Nudge and some of those other types of things, if you can get people aligned with the right set of behaviors and make it the default, that could help reduce some of these without having to also have the counselors. Now, that's not to say we don't need the counselors too, and we're grateful to the legislature for the additional funds to hire those. I think that they will make a big difference because there are other life issues that are going on. But the answer is not always more people.
Braden, can I follow up on that? I began my career as the director of academic advisement for undecided students, and I would respectfully ask the question, how many students come into college knowing what they're majoring in?
And
because your scenario plays out that they know what they're going to major in.
Right. And then they will change. And again, you know, it comes back to the metaphor of driving to San Diego. If I don't know which way I'm driving, I'm just driving west, then I'm going to take some extra time. To answer that question, we have to know something more about intent than I think we actually do at present. A lot of colleges actually encourage students very forcefully to declare a major, because we know that if they're taking the courses that will lead them toward their program, that they will better meet those requirements. The question becomes how hard do you push to get them into a major, and how hard do you let them do that exploration? And I think that a lot of it's going to depend on the sophistication of the student and the offerings at the college. And I think it's something that the industry as a whole is working to address, but there is not necessarily a magic bullet. Sure. We can tell you how many undeclared majors we have. What I don't know is how many of the people who are declared for, say, chemistry are soft chemistry, or are, you know, how many are in history are really pursuing something else. We just don't know.
Follow up to that in terms of numbers. So if someone comes to a college with an idea in mind that they're going to go into nursing, and then someone else is going in general studies and they haven't really decided what they're going to do, and one could argue that's a good thing that college helps you decide what you want to do. But do they take longer? Do we break them out between, say, a general studies student or a liberal arts student taking longer than somebody who's picked a career path?
These are not in this particular data collection, and one of the confounding factors is that some of those programs like engineering, education, nursing actually have more credits in them anyway. So it's very difficult to determine is the difference that you're seeing or the lack of difference that you're seeing an effect of the difference in length in program or the difference in course-taking patterns and completion. I've looked at some of these at the institution level. What we actually saw at Central when I was there doing this is that we saw higher graduation rates, mind you, of students who were in programs that had more credits in them. And the reason why is that was a set of engineering programs and nursing programs and education programs where the students were motivated and they actually had admission requirements and things like that. And those academic inputs allowed them to finish even the longer set of credits than those who were in the shorter programs.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just wanted to ask, it just seems incredible to me that an associate degree student going to school full-time won't complete for 4.3 years. I mean, the numbers don't seem to add up, because if, in fact, you are a full-time student, even if you had to do 80 credits, it's not over 4 years. So is there some kind of explanation behind the data?
Yes. And the explanation is that while someone starts full-time, they don't remain full-time. And that's the challenge in a lot of these, is that students don't always maintain constant enrollment statuses. So that while in high school, we have some expectation you're going to take some number of credits throughout, especially in lesser institutions that have a less selective profile, students will have, they will go full-time, part-time, part-time, full-time. If you were to take a look at the community college graduates, the 7,000 and change, a huge proportion of them, over 50%, has oscillated back and forth between those enrollment statuses.
So just to follow up then, the classification, that the label that you're given is what you anticipate coming in. So if you were classified as a full-time from the day one, you're still classified as a full-time even though you've dropped back. Is that correct?
That's correct in that particular data collection, and it's the way graduation rates are done too. And that's also some of the noise inside of graduation rates, is that students will drop to a part-time status. Yet we are assuming that they had intended to go full-time the whole time. We don't know, but it's again one of the analogs that's not very comparable between higher education and K-12.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. This is very interesting data, and it does certainly highlight major challenges in our population base. There's no question, particularly in the 18 to 24-year-old, and the increased competition and also shifting to older students. At the same time, it appears that we have a lot of demand for additional revenues for the higher educational institutions as well as additional staff. So it's going to be harder to make that argument when you look at this, unless there's new ways to reach a different set of students, such as reaching into the corporate section and going in and actually proposing that these students or employees might want to consider another degree or additional coursework that can help them in that particular field that they're in. So it appears that they're going to have to go digging for more. Otherwise, how do policymakers then handle the requests for additional staffing and revenues when in face of the actual demographics that show a trend to a shrinking population?
I think you're exactly right, Senator, and that's why I started off with the broad shifts in population and the sheer number of people going into health, elderly people going into health care and their needs versus a shrinking number of people who are served by colleges, at least traditionally as they have been to date. Money follows people. And I think that you're exactly right that what this calls for is if you want to sustain those budgets and those staffing models or increase those budgets and staffing models, you have to find out ways to serve more clients. And that can be older students. It can be students from other geographies. That's, you know, I throw up distance education on some of this, and, you know, often it has been thought of as a panacea. Oh, all of our problems will be solved. But I would say the past 15 or 20 years of distance education is littered with experiments gone awry, expensive experiments that have gone awry. So it can work, but it doesn't always work. So ultimately, I think that our institutions are going to have to wait to come up to serve these populations. There's probably a market in shorter-term graduate-level awards, because we know that we've got a large proportion of our population who have bachelor's degrees. Can you come up with an 18-credit, six-course package in data mining? Can you come up with something in healthcare information management systems that you can do in shorter term, provide the education that those particular people need, and can you do it without having to build some of the other apparatus that we've historically needed for academic programs? And I think that it's doable, but it hasn't been our historical business model.
Yes, I was going to respond to the earlier point about the complexity at the community college level in collecting the data and in understanding 4.5 years to get an associate degree. Part of that has to do with the delivery of remediation and remedial programs, because students might be in remedial courses, especially, as the point was made earlier, those who might be second English language learners, in which they're taking classes for a semester, two semesters, three, and they're enrolled and they're full-time, but they are receiving no credits. But to the point about graduate certificates, that really doesn't address the Obama challenge at all. We're not talking about graduate degrees. We're talking about those associate and bachelor degree programs. So finding ways to better and more efficiently and effectively prepare students to start gaining credits right away is the challenge that a lot of other states are also addressing. You know, and I used to formerly be with the City University of New York, which you know is a vast system, and working together with the public schools really challenged the high schools and started letting the population know that here are certain requirements so that students coming out would be a little bit better prepared and not have so many students. 70% going into remediation is a lot of college resources going to teach high school level credits, and they're not graduating with those credits. And I'll also add that the data, the national data show that students who are in school and at the end of a year don't have at least 20, 30 hours of credit get very discouraged. And so, you know, I'm going to college every day, and then at the end, I'm still a freshman. Makes people feel like, well, I'm not really worthy. I'm really
and
never
going
to.
And then they drop out.
Yeah.
Braden, just a clarification question. The developmental courses at the community colleges, they do carry credit, but they don't count towards matriculation to graduation. Is that counted in your, are those credits in your 84 credits?
The answer is yes, so that what we call billing hours are in there. And I'm actually on the advisory board for data collection for Complete College America. We had a robust discussion with the National Governors Association there about whether those should be in or out. My point was simply, at least let's consistently all put them in, or consistently all keep them out. We decided to put them in because I think that we were trying to illustrate the point that there are a large number of educational experiences that are going into these degree programs that have to occur in order for the students to get the credential at the end. And so, yes, that number's in there. By and large, though, that gets you to about 6 additional credits. And so that's why you see the community college number higher. It can go more than that, as we all know.
I had a slightly different tack here. You told us two different things. One was that the number of high school graduates is going down, but that currently only 47% of them get associate's or bachelor's degrees, and we need to get that number to 60% if we are to follow the president's directive. So do we really have a challenge? Is it just different students that we need to be addressing rather than a greater number?
Ultimately, in part, it depends on the age population that you've said you want to tackle. So that if you go all the way up to 65 years old, then you've got to be addressing some of the older students. What you don't see in the numbers here is that a lot of the completions, and this is where I think John Chimo's point about how many are state residents and how many are not comes back, is that a lot of the students who are in our completions numbers are actually from out of state and then move back to where they were. We have a number of students who actually go to college out of state. They don't necessarily come back at the same rates. And so the populations with which you are left, you've got to make sure that you are hitting that appropriate 60-65% number to address those. And I think as well there are pockets, if not large pockets, in the older population, like the where Gen Y is now, 25 to 34, where we have some opportunity. The slide I have up right here, again, is that set of numbers where between 25 and 44, we have 171,000 people who have some college but haven't finished their degree. Those could be certificates, but they, also could be people who started degree programs and just haven't finished them up.
So there's an enormous population there that if we were more effective with our programs, we would be getting to the 60%.
Yes. Yes.
Great point. Commissioner.
Working on, thank you, putting together a package so their community colleges would actually receive better funding when they produce better outcomes. Have you, which I think is actually an intriguing idea to try to solve at least a couple of the problems we're talking about here, have you seen that in any other location, and is it work? I mean, can it help?
There are probably 8 to maybe 10 states that are pursuing performance funding. I spent 4 years in South Carolina. I'm going to use this phrase. Pursuing performance funding whole hog. And I mean whole hog doing this. Tennessee is one of those. Whether they will see increased outcomes on this, is the jury's still out. The previous, I'm going to call it performance funding 1.0, really went from about 1985 probably into the mid-2000s. And one of the challenges that the states that pursued it followed, South Carolina was actually one of them, Tennessee did some, there's pockets elsewhere, was that not enough money was attached to the outcomes. And so people were competing for funds, but it just wasn't big enough of a pie. Tennessee's entire state appropriation now is linked to credit production, degree production, or some other production metric. I think that what we read about today in the Boston Globe about Massachusetts Community College said it was about half of their state appropriations. The metaphor I use with that is it's like when I get contract work done on my house. It's half up front and half when the job is done. So there certainly are models about that, about increasing incentives. For the states that have done it, though, and we've tracked at least bachelor's degree completion outcomes, you actually don't see any effect in completion rates across the states that have done it yet, which isn't to say it's not the right thing to do. It's just that the data don't seem to necessarily correspond with the implementation of performance funding.
Yeah, I just would like to make a point that addresses a question that was raised earlier, and that is that just because the number of juniors or seniors or high school students is shrinking, that doesn't necessarily mean that the number of students going to college or university in Connecticut will shrink. So your metaphor for your 529 savings for your children is what we're seeing at UConn. We expected 3,250 freshmen this year. We probably will come in about 3,700. So we're up. And I think one of the reasons we're up, when we look at who's coming to us, it's a lot of students who would have gone to private institutions out of state who are Connecticut students who are staying in state. So I just want to make sure we're clear that these things don't follow the same path. We may see reductions in numbers of high school students, but if we do a good job and the value is there and the completion is there, we should see equivalent or even higher numbers of students perhaps deciding not to go out of state, staying in their home state. And, of course, if they go to college in their home state, they're more likely to settle here. So, I mean, our trend right now is good, and I think we just need to be aware that, the two numbers may not follow a parallel track.
I think that's a really good point, Sally. And I just wanted to follow up with, to go back to your point, Braden, that I think something we really need to think about is that we have a host of colleges, private, public, who haven't dealt with what we're dealing with now, which is convincing more students to go to college, which is turning more of those students that come in into degrees, that we've had a plentiful supply of entering college students. And I think our plan is going to have to reflect some best practices to change that. And I think that's one of your big takeaways I'm getting here. This is really helpful. It's sort of like, how do you, when you're running for office, how do you turn that person who doesn't vote into a voter? Well, you don't pay any attention to them, but now they're realizing, well, you can find a portion of them, and you just have to figure out who to target, who you're going to be successful turning. And to me, the college sort of recruitment is a lot like that. You're trying to target what students are going to do best at your college, are going to want to come to your college, and then how do you turn that undecided into someone that goes to UConn instead of going to University of Maryland? You know, and that's, I think, so we have some serious changes in an industry that hasn't faced this in years.
Yeah, and in fact, that the group of students that we're getting that's been most surprising, actually, are the very highest SAT kids. So in a lot of cases, it's the parents that, you know, don't want to spend $250,000 or $300,000 when they've got a really strong state alternative. So I think that's a critical thing for us to look at, and we can provide some data if you're interested in it. We our honors program is up significantly, which I think is also, we know kind of where the decision points are and where they come, but to have a stronger honors program and a bigger honors program means that the Connecticut students that are staying are some of the brightest students. In fact, the greatest proportion for our honors students this year, our increase, is students over 1,500 SATs. That says a lot about who's staying in Connecticut, and we're really pleased about that demographic.
Just an anecdote to follow that up. I had an intern here today who is looking at MIT, Brown, a couple of other really top schools, and went to see UConn 2 weeks ago, and he spoke as highly about UConn as he did about the others, and I thought 5 years ago, that student wouldn't have even come to a tour of UConn. So I think it speaks to some of the work you've been doing to recruit students at the top. So thank you.
NextGen made a huge difference. The blip up this year, 3,200 is what we expected. 3,700 is our entering freshman class. A lot of that is excitement about STEM and engineering and honor students, too. The new extension of the honors program, I think, made a very, very big difference, and we're really grateful.
Actually, Sally, I have a question for you. UConn is attracting the student coming right out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
That's your target audience. Do you continue to, does the university continue to see that as the future for you, and that there'll be enough students coming into the pipeline to do that? Or, you know, would you start looking to market to the older returning adult learner of 25?
We're going to do both. We're doing both. We have a very big investment now in an online certificate program because of the demographic data that Braden's mentioned. We've looked at it as well. We think the future probably is not going to be in more master's degrees, and you pointed that out, but rather in certificate courses, the 9 credits, 12 credits, 15 credits. We very much would like to have more of a share of engineering masters, for example, downtown Hartford engineering masters, and we think our move downtown will make a big difference with that. But, you know, we still see our primary charge being educating students that are leaving high school and hopefully coming to UConn, as well as other state institutions. But we are on a separate track also doing online certificate programs. We hope to add 10 a year for the next 10 years in critical areas of economic development. We're working closely looking at what the state needs as well. I mean, areas like engineering and big data, for example, is a huge area. We will be happy to know we're going to do an early childhood disability program online. So we're trying to look at areas that we know are critical need to the state. So we're trying to do both.
And to follow up on that, do you know what the other private universities are doing in this regard in terms of looking at the 25? Does anyone happen to know if you're
looking at that returning 25-year-old student? Or
absolutely. I think almost every institution these days addresses the adult student population, the returning student, mm-hmm. and as well as looking at transfers, those students who go out of state and then decide to come back. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's a very competitive market, and everyone is looking at exactly these same demographics, state to state, and within the state. So the independents are definitely addressing those. You know, it used to be that even a Yale wouldn't have programs for adult students, and now they do.
Any last questions? If not, just an observation. I remember from some early training a saying that somebody said to me, "In God we trust, all others bring data." And I think that this is particularly evident today, and I think in some of the comments about what some of our institutions here are doing to respond suggests that that is a very critical piece about using data, and hopefully as we do find a good consultant to guide our process, that this data will be very, very, very key. I thank you, Braden. This is wonderful stuff. And you promised scary, and it is a bit, so... hopefully it will guide our thinking as we go forward. So with that, let me move just briefly on to next September meeting. Now, if you remember, we have twice now talked about distance learning, and I think, again, came forward in Braden's comments, and there was some considerable interest in hearing a presentation for distance learning. So I don't want to forget that for the September meeting, if that meets with people's needs. Is this something that we feel, and I'm trying to remember, is it Lois that we talked to about distance learning? I think she's...
Lois was very interested in distance learning and wanted to ask us. The only question I would have is whether we might have a consultant coming to our September meeting, and whether that would be, is that possible that everything contract would be in place by September?
He was saying contract only by mid-September, so that's the only reason I asked.
Oh, okay.
It'll be tight.
I mean, if there's some flexibility, I mean, perhaps what we ought to do is line up the presentation, but if we have the consultant, perhaps we want to go for it. I think certainly the faster we get going. So are people comfortable with that, A, with the distance learning if we need a topic, and B, if the consultant is in, we want to bring them forward? That was easy.
Gee, well, yes, well, John. What we'll do is we'll keep you posted along the way, and if everything falls into place quickly, we'll let you know, and then you can plan accordingly.
John.
So is there any chance that we could bring in a speaker from another state that has gone through a similar process, strategic planning process, and talk about their experience and, as importantly, how they've fared in terms of implementation? I mean, I recognize that we don't have travel budgets, or I assume we don't for that, but boy, it'd be very enlightening to have someone come in. And now that we've identified a consultant, so it wouldn't really matter whether or not that consultant worked in that state or not. I know that was an issue to bring someone from another state in prior to the selection of the consultant.
Reactions?
Yeah, there are a couple of boards, like United Educators, that regularly do this kind of national data assessment, and some place like that might be good for information on online, rather than just looking at a single system or institution.
In terms of addressing John's question about someone from another state that has actually gone through this process, if you remember, I believe Judy Greiman reviewed a number of those states with us about those that she thought really had done some reasonable work. Perhaps we can talk with them, and I don't know, again, you know, without a travel budget, whether we can do this, but certainly I saw a lot of heads nodding that that's also a very good meeting. Yes, Jason.
Yep, Judy, I would just actually say that I think it's a great idea to bring somebody in who's done something in another state. I would even morph it with the previous topic, which was distance learning. So going back to this chart, I would suggest that whoever we get, we might want to get somebody from one of the states that's on this end of the spectrum. Because I think we tend to think we do a lot in terms of distance learning here in Connecticut. and we clearly do not. So I think we should look at one of those. I think we should look at possibly bringing somebody in from one of those other states that is on the left side of that particular chart.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate it. Your last comment was very telling. We recently, all of us, have gotten to know the new president of the Board of Regents, who actually brought forward the issue that we're like 49th. And here in this chart it says 45th, but it from some other information he has, we're like 49th in distance learning, which is incredibly low and makes us wonder, you know, what we're doing in that area and how much focus. But I do have a comment or a question for the committee itself on how the work and work product and then result of this committee's strategic plan work and planning is going to dovetail with the new president of the Board of Regents' current strategy, and apparently they're working on a strategic plan as well. So I'd love to know how that's going to dovetail together, how they're going to bring all of that together, so it'll be one strategic plan instead of different strategic plans going out.
I think Braden might be the best person to answer this, since he's the one that's working on this plan. Reactions?
I think that the board's strategic framework that they approved actually last September, and they had some adjustments and modifications throughout the year, and then really reaffirmed in June, along with the approval of separate mission statements for the community colleges, state universities, and Charter Oak, and identified some metrics, is actually closely aligned with the accountability system that the Higher Education Coordinating Council approved at the end of last year. And by and large, they arrived at that through a process not dissimilar from this, looking at a whole bunch of other state strategic plans and identifying five areas that I think we're going to find very closely dovetail with the things that we're going to do. I would actually be surprised if we don't have just magic 80% alignment just to begin with. And I think that as we actually have, you know, Commissioner Smith is on that board, as is Commissioner Pryor. We have a representative here, and I think that, you know, the idea is to have all of our institutions have enough skin in the game with all this that what we have reflects both the vision forward, but is connected to our current realities.
Commissioner Smith.
You know, just to add on to that comment, you know, there are a number of strategic efforts underway, not just at the Board of Regents, but the community. I mean, the technical schools are reviewing their strategy. You know, you've got the P20 board. I think all of these things we do need to try to weave together and not duplicate efforts as much as we possibly can. So I fully support that. Just one other thing on distance learning and our potential opportunity to bring in a speaker. I'd suggest we do these things together. Let's use technology if we find a state far, far away, like Arizona, to use video conferencing or something. And John says he has some contacts that could help us set that up. It's just a suggestion.
Just one last thing. We should not forget our own CTDLC, Connecticut Distance Learning Council, and maybe have someone from that organization be part of the discussion.
I think early on we had actually mentioned Ed Klonowski and Jason. You know, Jason, you represent Charter Oak, yes?
Yeah, my appointment technically.
We do, but.
But Ed is in charge of both. Ed, he's the
right.
Leader of.
Yeah, he's sort of the birthing parent of CTDLC, I think, as it goes. It sounds like we have our marching orders, but I do like the idea, certainly, of using technology to bring in someone from another state. It's certainly more efficient. It demonstrates the use of the technology, and I think we'll huddle behind.
I just want to follow up on bringing someone in who's gone through the strategic plan. I certainly have been advocating for that from the very beginning, because I thought it would be very helpful and give us a roadmap. Now that we have a consultant that will be coming on shortly, I think once we as a group have a better handle on the process, we'll be able to ask somebody from another state some advice and clearly on where we're going, but also in the implementation part of it. I mean, it's wonderful to come up with a plan, but unless we're going to make it happen, and that's, to me, that's the critical element of this. Thank you, John, for raising it.
Yes, Madam Chair, just to reiterate, it would be really helpful, I think, if all of the various groups that are engaged in separate types of strategic plans should come together at some focal point so that it becomes one general plan for higher educational institutions, and that they meld together the best ideas from each of these committees that Commissioner Smith just remarked upon, because they all have to be worked together and implemented from one source at the end of the day, I would think.
Great suggestion. I mean, I do think that there are representatives of all of those efforts sitting around this group here as well, too, and perhaps we can have a sidebar conversation about, at some point, you know, creating a place for that conversation to happen as well. Thoughtful comments. Thank you. Yeah. So we'll huddle and figure out. I think we've heard the marching orders, and let's see what we can make happen depending on what happens with the consultants and the contract, and it's kind of chicken and egg stuff. But it is important to mention the next date, September 10th, and hopefully that will accommodate most people's schedules. So hopefully we will see you all there and others besides. But thank you for a very robust discussion. Thank you, Braden. That was just terrific.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.